Perimeter is a really nice place. I wish I could be here a little bit longer. So the talk I've prepared is it's a little bit of a grab bag, kind of a representative sampling of topics that I've worked on, since I don't think I know any of you really until today, some exceptions. Just going to give a brief introduction to kind of who I am, what I work on. So I spend my time working on some combination of these three things: high energy astrophysics, computing, algorithms, and software development, and basic physics of fluids and plasmas, and in particular relativistic fluids. So I spend my time somewhere in the midst of those things, while trying to maintain somewhat of a sense of humor. Okay, so I'm going to give one slide on a recent project that I'm very excited about, and then I'm going to try to partition the remaining time in these four topics. So some words on basic properties of relativistic hydrodynamic turbulence, and a little bit on magnetohydrodynamic turbulence and its applications in binary neutron star mergers. And then I'll talk a little bit about gamma ray burst prompt emission theory, and hopefully, if there's time, some modeling of the gamma ray burst afterglow that was associated with the GW17817 event. So this is the one slide topic, something I'm really excited about. It is a project that I've been working on with my collaborators, Federico Fusa and Paulo Alves, who are plasma physicists at SLAC. I believe that we have uncovered a basic ingredient in the reason that jets from supermassive black holes are able to shine, so why these jets produce light, and also why their radiation is so non-thermal. So what we found is that the reason that AGN jets produce light is likely not one of the two options that have been offered historically. Namely, those are that hydrodynamic shocks accelerate particles in the jet, the other option being magnetic reconnection in a more conventional sense. What we have here is a new process which is related, like magnetic reconnection, to the dissipation of magnetic energy, but it has to do specifically with a process known as the helical kink instability, which dissipates magnetic energy that is associated with the magnetic field that winds, that coils around the axis or the spine of the AGN jet. And in the course of that instability, we found, using very, very high resolution simulations of first principles plasma physics, that this instability is very efficient at accelerating non-thermal particles. So in the context of AGN jets, I think the study has a lot of potential in terms of modeling. So we can model morphological and spectral and temporal characteristics of the radiation from AGN jets using this type of scenario. But it's also really interesting from the perspective of basic plasma physics, because this opens the door on doing reconnection studies in macroscopic scale systems. So here we're looking at how magnetic energy dissipates in context, rather than looking just at the microscopic, for example, current layers where reconnection may take place. So this is work is on the archive, and it's accepted at PRL, and I could be happy to talk about it more later. But for now, I'm going to start by going back a little bit. This is work that I did with Andrew McFadgen when I was a graduate student. And our goal here was to begin characterizing relativistic turbulence. So turbulence is an old problem in classical physics. I would say it's a building block of fluid dynamics. And let me back up and just define. So turbulence means the chaotic flow of a liquid or a gas. And it's a highly nonlinear problem. So primary means of approaching it tend to be numerical, and so we need big simulations. There are a number of applications where fluids are likely to be turbulent, and where the gas has relativistic properties in one way or the other, and I'll quantify those on the next slide. But for now, I'll just say Those settings are broadly high energy density physics, laboratory applications, early universe cosmology, and high energy astrophysics. In all of those settings, we have fluids which may be relativistic in one way or another and which are susceptible to turbulence. So of the many questions that we could potentially pose and try to explore, I'm just going to cover two really basic ones. The first is, does relativistic turbulence even exist? And I'll pose that problem, that question more precisely in the next slide. And can it be characterized in terms of well-known theories of turbulence? What generalizations might we need to make from Newtonian fluids to relativistic fluids in order to make comparisons between old established theories and what may be needed to describe relativistic turbulence? So turbulence, like I was saying, it can be relativistic in multiple ways. The first way is that it can be kinematically relativistic, which would mean that the fluctuating velocity field can approach the speed of light. That's what we mean by kinematically relativistic turbulence. This is very likely or certain to arise in the context of the outflows associated with gamma ray bursts and likely with the outflows associated with jets from active galactic nuclei or jets from supermassive black holes. Another way that turbulence can be relativistic is that it can be thermally relativistic. This is the case when the speed of sound in the fluid is comparable to the speed of light. Another way of saying that is that the internal energy density is comparable to the rest mass energy density. This is very likely the case in newly born neutron stars and at the inner edges of black hole accretion flows. And there is yet another way that turbulence can be relativistic, and that is magnetic. That's where we have a plasma whose magnetic field is very strong, such that the magnetic energy density competes with or even vastly exceeds the rest mass energy of the plasma particles. And this is definitely the case in neutron star magnetospheres and in the regions in black hole magnetospheres where jets are actually launched. To deal with these different settings for relativistic turbulence, we have hydrodynamic treatments. So this means we're just assuming local thermodynamic equilibrium everywhere, high collisionality, and we're ignoring magnetic fields. This work was pioneered by a few people starting around 2010, 2011. We also have magnetohydrodynamic turbulence, which is, again, where we're making fluid approximations, but we're also including the effects and dynamics of magnetic fields. I'm also including in the magnetohydrodynamic category the dynamics of force-free electrodynamics. So force-free electrodynamics is a limit of magnetohydrodynamics where the magnetic field is so strong that we can neglect the rest mass energy density of the plasma. And this work has been done by, Jung-Yun Cho was the first one, began working on this back in 2006. My advisor and myself have done some work on it. Will and I have also done some work on it. And this is a very interesting setting, and next section of the talk will focus on that. And there's also this exciting regime, which is fully kinetic plasma turbulence, which means that all the fluid approximations are thrown out, and we solve the equations, as the Vlasov-Maxwell equations of plasma dynamics, meaning Maxwell's equations plus the Lorentz force law for the individual particles, and that's all done from first principles. So this is an exciting avenue. It's being explored very aggressively right now by multiple groups, and I've put them on three rows. Each of them has actually looked at slightly different variations of the problem. Luca Camiso and Lorenzo Cerroni right now at Columbia University are looking at freely decaying turbulence using fully kinetic approach. The Colorado group on the middle line has been looking at continuously driven. They drive turbulence continuously, and they're looking for how particles accelerate turbulence. And also, I'm including this group that I was part of, and so was Will, at Stanford, where we were looking at magnetic field instabilities, so macroscopic scale instabilities, not unlike the one I was exemplifying on the first slide. And these things I would also put in a category of turbulence. So these are three different avenues that fully kinetic simulations have been looking at turbulence. So I think the best way to be introduced to a subject is just to meet it face to face. First, This is the first impression that we got of relativistic turbulence. This is a two-dimensional slice of a three-dimensional simulation done with my own code at the NASA Ames computing facility. The resolution is high. There are roughly 2,000 cells in each of the three dimensions. It's a very large simulation. The colors here are representing the velocity field, and in particular, it's the velocity component that's out of and into the page. And we can learn something right away just by looking at the morphology of the structures here.
So there's no color there.
There's no color.
It's black and white.
It's black and white. Would you prefer color?
When you said color, it's
black. I'm.
I don't know. I guess so.
I should say I'm colorblind. So to me, this is not completely, but somewhat. So this to me is basically as colorful as the world gets.
It sounds like a missed opportunity.
Oh,
you have color versions. Like
I do, actually. Red is a nice one. There's a rendering of this thing that's hanging up now in the NYU physics department. They wanted the red one.
It should be single color, cannot have multiple colors.
I think they also wanted a monochromatic color scheme. Yeah. So what's being shown here, normal component of velocity. So when you see these structures here, what you're looking at are shear. You're looking at shear layers, so places where the component of the velocity field that's into and out of the board is reversing its sign. This image is of the in-plane velocity. So it's actually the velocity going this way. And you can tell it's not quite isotropic. Where you see discontinuities, they tend to be aligned in this direction. It's because those are shocks. That's where two flows are converging on one another. You see different type of morphological structures. And again, this is a density field, and we see yet the completely different type of morphological structure. You see these ropes here. We see cavities, voids. This is where the density is low.
Is this a cut, or is this not a 3D rendering?
This is also a cut.
Oh.
Despite that it has, it kind of looks three-dimensional. But that is...
So there are shocks in there as well?
There are shocks, yes. So one of the first quantitative diagnostics that we deploy on something like this is a power spectrum. The power spectrum just means the sum of the Fourier amplitudes that comprise a given wavelength of the velocity field.
Excuse me, out of curiosity, what is the initial condition?
Our initial condition is homogeneous unmoving gas, and it is driven continuously from the largest scale using a forcing term. That forcing term hits only the very longest mode, but it wiggles around in time so that we're not always driving the same mode.
So what is relativistic here?
Yes, good question. So this is driven from the outer scale with a relativistic four velocity. So this is relativistic in the first two senses. It's kinematically relativistic. And it's also relativistically warm, in the sense that the sound speed here is about one-third the speed of light. And so the thermal energy density is comparable to the rest mass energy density. So many of you are probably familiar. There's Kolmogorov's ideas about turbulence. The general expectation is that the velocity field power spectrum has a power law dependence on the wave number k, like k to the power of minus 5/3. So we would have liked to make that comparison directly with the Kolmogorov expectation. But as you might have anticipated, relativistic turbulence would not be able to have that property because the three velocity cannot exceed c. So we'd be unable to observe these fluctuations in the velocity field out to very large scales where the velocity field is highly relativistic. By the way, in this setting, the outer scale Lorentz factor was between 3 and 4. So it's becoming not quite ultra-relativistic, but it's up there. So what we did is we used the 4 velocity. So we can construct similar power spectrum using a very simple generalization of 4 velocity. And these are what we get. We do get spectra that are broadly Kolmogorov, 5/3. But if you look more closely, you'll see that they're not quite. In fact, if you under-resolved the simulation, you might have been tricked. So here we're increasing the resolution by a factor of 2-4 times. And when we get to 1024 cubed, we might have stopped our simulations and opened some champagne and said, we got it. Look at that beautiful decade or so worth of 5/3 power law, but we double the resolution again and it goes away. There's a couple lessons to be learned there. One is that, look, turbulence is complicated. It's not, I don't know if it's natural or wise to expect single power law solutions just because there are phenomenological ideas that would expect such solutions. I haven't yet been able to do 4096 cubed. If I could, which I must say I think might be a fool's errand, but if I could do it, I don't know what I would expect. Would this one get longer? Would that one get longer? Or would it just stay in the middle? Maybe there would still be two segments. Maybe the indices would change. I really don't know what to expect.
Sorry, just to back up, what exactly is the power? How are you calculating that in the four velocity?
So this P of K?
Yeah.
So P of K is a one-dimensional power spectrum. So I'm taking the Fourier modes in each of the three directions, and then I'm binning them into cylindrical shells.
But just how do you calculate the, so I mean, the four velocity, like all vectors have the same magnitude, right? But how are you taking?
Oh, yes, good point. Yeah, that's the spatial components.
Okay.
Yes, it's not the, yeah, that dot product means just the spatial components.
It's like the momentum of the particle.
Yes, modulo the density, the fact that the density varies as well. But yes, it's gamma beta squared. So I would like to know, but I don't yet, which of those is the true index, or if neither is the true index. So nevertheless, I would stand back from this and say this is still broadly Kolmogorov. We're still observing a cascade of energy through scales. We're still seeing energy being injected at the largest scale and cascading down to smaller scales. So I do sort of take pride that this is the first demonstration that such phenomenology does broadly hold in the relativistic setting. On the right is a decomposition between the different types of velocity modes. So in general, you know, you can decompose any vector field into the part of it that does and does not have divergence, like one part that has only divergence and the other part that has only curl. So if you do that, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, no, I was going to slightly deviate. This is 3D. What about 2D? In 2D, you can increase the resolution much more. Of course, turbulence is very different.
Yes.
You can still go relativistic in 2D.
Yes, you can. And you can observe just as psychedelic and beautiful structures in two dimensions. Really interesting and somewhat exact analytic interpretations, but much weaker connections to real things in astrophysics. I've done, and in combination with Will, some studies on the two-dimensional magnetic setting. It's really interesting. I didn't include it in the talk. And Luis has also done work in the two-dimensional hydrodynamic setting. It's beautiful and it's fun and there's really, it's more, not much more attackable from analytic using analytic tools.
And does it connect to the non-relativistic 2D turbulence, or is there a big difference?
Well, it is also similar in the sense that there is still this same set of quadratic invariants. So there's this thing called entropy, which continues to be conserved also in the relativistic setting. So the same set of concepts does apply, and you do see this inverse energy cascade. Okay, good. So all that we saw here was that the compressive modes follow a single power law much better. So it does look like this cascade of acoustic modes follows a single power law, while the solenoidal ones are responsible for causing this bump, this deviation from a single power law in the power spectrum. Good. There are other ways that we can characterize relativistic turbulence as well. And this is what I meant by that very first question. Well, how does this thing address? The first question, does relativistic turbulence even exist? What do I mean by that? Is like, let's say that we do stir this box at the largest scale. A reasonable skeptic would say, well, how do you know that thing even stays relativistic? Maybe you just drive at the largest scale, and as soon as you get down to one half that scale, all the fluctuating velocities are already sub-relativistic, in which case there would really be no such thing as relativistic turbulence. Sure, maybe you can stir it very fast at one scale, but there's not a cascade of relativistic turbulence. That is a possibility, but I'd say that this is evidence to the contrary. Because here, what we see is this is the on the horizontal axis here is scale. The right-hand side is the largest scale where the simulation is being driven from. And the left-hand side is the small scale where things are dissipating. And what we see is that there is a cascade to both sides of this critical scale, which you can think of as a relativistic scale. This is where, this is the scale at which velocity fluctuations become sub-relativistic. The typical relative velocity between two fluid elements separated by this length scale, which happens to be about 1/20th of the box size, becomes gamma beta less than 1. So there is a relativistic cascade and there is a Newtonian cascade. To see this, we also needed to generalize the structure functions. Structure functions are a different characteristic. They're related to the power spectrum, but they're more like an autocorrelation. It's like just checking for the magnitude of the difference between the velocity field as sampled at two points, which are separated by a given length. That's a structure function. And the structure functions, this is our relativistic generalization, by the way, I'm not going to go into this. This thing reduces to the conventional Newtonian one, and this is this can be used to measure higher order intermittency properties. So in other words, characterizing the non-Gaussianity of this field. So one of the initial corrections to the original Kolmogorov theory was noticing that the field is not Gaussian. It's not just uncorrelated noise. But there are structures, as you saw in those images, very rich structures in turbulence. And those things can be quantified by looking at the higher order statistics of those two-point correlation functions. And so there's this theory by Shane Levesque, which applies formally only to incompressible and Newtonian turbulence, but which we found a way to extend to the relativistic setting. And it required this generalization of these two-point correlation functions. Okay, so the upshot here is that we can make connection with known ways of characterizing and diagnosing turbulence from the Newtonian setting, and we can update those prescriptions for relativistic cases.
Sorry, it looks like the Kolmogorov is consistent with an error bar. I don't know what's happening down there, but at low keys.
Yes.
But push it a little bit higher up.
Yeah.
That would go through.
I can't remember which sigma, whether that was the one or two sigmas, but if you also multiply by each probability that each of them was off, I would say it's likely significant.
But I mean, they're not independent. I guess I don't know how you can say whether it's an independent error bar. But it's the same turbulent medium, right?
It is. It is based off of multiple realizations, though, of turbulence. So it's the same problem, but with different random number seeds.
Right. And so these error bars, are they correlated or not? I don't know.
Can be. I would say there probably are correlated. Yeah. That's a good point.
So what's the other group? It's 99.
This guy, right? Yes. So this is a correction to Kolmogorov's theory to trying to count for intermittency. So in the Kolmogorov theory, you have this this dependence here, a perfectly straight line corresponds to a Gaussian random field. Any Gaussian random field, which is analyzed using structure functions, would show a linear dependence here.
So you're saying even if it's relativistic, it's still agrees with this Newtonian?
It can be connected to it, yeah. If we were to have used the precise diagnostic that we used for Shane Levesque, we would not have been able to see this connection simply because the free velocity is not exceeding c. But using a proper generalization, it looks like intermittency can be characterized.
So can I ask something? In the previous slides you had, this one. So I guess, are you just looking at the slopes of those two lines and they said they're not exactly the same slope, so that's why Newtonian cascade is different from relativistic cascade? Is that what you're...
Actually, yes, I should clarify this. I wish this other one wasn't there, because both of those lines, this one and this one, come from the same simulation. And this one is just a, this is the parallel structure function. But please, but
they're the same. So what is the internal investment? Okay, so sorry, can you then repeat that one? What are we comparing now here?
Sure, so this structure function, it is limited to the velocity field and its components that are what's called the longitudinal structure function. Whereas this one is a total structure function. So it's the velocity difference considering all components of the velocity field. And so both lines come from the same simulation. And the relativistic and Newtonian are meant to.
Are the lines or?
They indicate left or right of this relativistic scale. So what I'm trying to show is that to the right of the relativistic scale, at large scales, there is a cascade where there's energy transfer between relativistic eddies and slightly less relativistic eddies and so on. Whereas to the left of this line, this is actually in a Newtonian regime, at least kinematically.
So you actually transition over to a Newtonian regime on a small scale.
Exactly, yes, on a small s. It's actually quite analogous to how in supersonic turbulence, there's a subscale where there's a transition to subsonic turbulence. It's analogous to that. Okay, so regretfully, I should move on. I want to talk a little bit about MHD turbulence. And again, there are a great number of questions to be asked. And for the purpose of this talk, I've just chosen one which I think is most applicable in multi-messenger astrophysics. And it has to do with the generation of magnetic fields during the coalescence of binary neutron star systems. So magnetic fields are quite likely to influence all stages of two binary neutron stars, or a binary neutron star coalescing. That includes the electromagnetic counterpart, is the radiation that is going to be produced by the system, and also its physics, the dynamics of the merger itself. Magnetic fields can also be developed during the merger. So we don't need to be working necessarily with the magnetic fields that existed in the neutron stars before they collided. We also need to think about how the collision itself can lead to the amplification of magnetic fields. And that process in general is referred to as dynamo. So dynamo in general simply means the conversion of kinetic energy into magnetic energy in an MHD setting. So I'm just going to go through a couple of the ways that it's known that magnetic fields are likely to influence dynamics and indeed the observable dynamics of neutron star mergers. So one of those is that the gravitational waveform can be modified. These are simulations done with full numerical relativity. Bruno Giacomasso, also worked by Zachary Etienne, that shows that when the neutron stars were initiated with very strong magnetic fields, that the waveform of the coalescing stars can be different. There's also a lot of talk recently of, going back about 10, 12 years now, but much more so recently, of the potential that an electromagnetic precursor signal could precede the gravitational wave radiation due to the interaction of the two neutron stars' magnetospheres. So the physics of this is something I definitely don't have time to get into, but I just wanted to point out that it's being worked on. And this would again apply if both stars had strong magnetospheres. So if both were magnetized before the merger got going. Okay, we also have the influence of the magnetic field on the post-merger remnant. So if the merger remnant did not promptly collapse to a black hole, then the magnetic fields that are in the remnant can influence how this differentially rotating star redistributes its angular momentum. As many of you may know, a hypermassive neutron star is avoiding collapsing to a black hole simply by virtue of its differential rotation. So the presence of magnetic fields as they redistribute angular momentum can, in principle, accelerate the collapse of the star to a black hole. So they're important dynamically in this sense. There's also the possibility that they can drive winds. On the left is a baryon-loaded wind, which is driven by the introduction of magnetic pressure via winding to the surface layers of the neutron star. And these are simulations by Dan Siegel. And on the right-hand side, it's a cartoon of the magnetosphere of a neutron star. And if a magnetosphere forms with a neutron star that has that has living for quite a long time before collapsing to a black hole, Then there's electromagnetic spin-down luminosity, and that is potentially observable in this type of a cartoon where there's a nebula that forms around the star. There's a shell of material that is the debris that was ejected dynamically during the coalescence. And a pair plasma nebula can be formed inside that thing, and X-rays can leak out and be potentially observable. But the power of that thing is set completely by the strength of the magnetic field and also the rotation speed of the remnant neutron star. Okay, so so magnetic fields have observable consequences. Okay, there are basically two types of dynamo that may be involved. One of them is a small-scale dynamo, and the other is a large-scale. And these things are kind of what they sound like. A small-scale dynamo simply means the generation of short wavelength magnetic field. And the only ingredient that is typically required for that is turbulence. If there's low resistivity and a lot of turbulence, a small-scale dynamo is quite a robust expectation. A mean field dynamo is much more mysterious and much more of an open problem, but that refers to the development of a large-scale magnetic field. And this would be what is required to see formation of a jet, for example, if there is an accretion disk onto a nascent black hole. A large-scale magnetic field is likely required in order to activate the Blandford-Znaik process that would facilitate the extraction of rotational kinetic energy of that black hole. Similarly, in the cartoon from the previous slide, this guy, a large-scale magnetic field is necessary to get dipole spin down. So in general, a mean field dynamo is a kind of a holy grail of this topic. It is much harder to look at. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about this one, because I think we have quite high confidence in what we think is happening via small-scale dynamo to amplify small-scale magnetic fields. So there are many ways that turbulence can be generated in the course of a neutron star merger. I've just outlined a couple of those here. There are shearing instabilities that take place during the onset of mass transfer. So when the neutron stars are at the end of the N spiral, there's shear between the two surfaces, and that shear can be Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable, which leads to a significant level of turbulence in the outer layers of the star. There's also the possibility for neutrino-driven convection. There's also magnetorotational instability that should affect the differentially rotating merger remnant should it not yet have collapsed to black hole. There's an instructional estimate that we can do, which is just to compare the energy density in turbulence and the energy density in magnetic fields should those magnetic fields grow to equipartition with the turbulence. So let's just suppose that Kelvin-Helmholtz instability succeeds in driving turbulence at 0.1 the speed of light. That is based on crude estimates from global simulations. That's not an unrealistic expectation. And let's say that a small-scale dynamo succeeds in converting a order unity fraction of the associated kinetic energy into magnetic fields, then the magnetic field strength is in excess of 10 to the 16 Gauss. So that's a magnetar level and is already interesting. Whether that is actually realized or not, that depends on how long it takes for the small-scale dynamo to operate. And that's how long for the magnetic fields to grow from some very low, potentially very low level up to that equipartition level. So this motivated me to do turbulence simulations to test that length of time. How long does it take for magnetic fields to grow into equipartition? So this is a movie of a three-dimensional simulation. Again, cut planes, no volume rendering. The camera's swirling around the box. The box is actually stationary. And the color here is the magnetic field strength. You can see that after a couple of dynamical times, which you can kind of gauge from looking at the motions there, that the magnetic field is well distributed throughout the volume and is, well, you can't see the strength, but I'll show you in the next slide. This is equipartition. So this is a movie that is showing as a function of the number of dynamical times, the number of eddy turnover times, how close to equipartition the magnetic field is getting. So when these two lines meet, that's equipartition.
So what is the definition of equipartition?
Yeah, that would mean that b squared over 8 pi is comparable to rho c squared.
Okay. compared to Rossius. Okay. Mm-hmm.
If it was relativistically hot, it would be rho h c squared, wanting to account for the gas enthalpy.
Sorry, but rho, what is h?
H being the specific enthalpy.
Yes.
This gas is relativistically warm. It's rho c squared, the temperature is like 20% of rho c squared. Okay. So we do reach equipartition, and the time for it to take to complete itself is typically four eddy turnover times. So we have to turn that into physical times in order to connect it with the merger. But global simulations suggest that when Kelvin-Helmholtz instability is operating, the outer scale, the eddies, are on the scale of about a kilometer, and are indeed of about 1/10 the speed of light. So that sets the dynamical time scale, which is about 1/10 of a millisecond. And so if we have 5 eddy turnover times, there is enough turbulence is then sustained over a long enough period of time for equipartition level fields.
So are you simulating neutron star or
these are controlled simulations of driven turbulence. So the assumption here is that the turbulence that operates during the onset of the coalescence is as if somebody were just stirring it continuously.
So the density is what it is called neutron star?
Yes. So the density is the same as the density of neutron star material in the surface layers.
Yeah. But then I see this blue line has a different power over here. So you have some label clearly.
Yes.
Sorry, what are the green and blue lines again?
So I didn't say so. On the left-hand side, green is the kinetic energy power spectrum, and blue is the magnetic energy power spectrum. Now, it's a known characteristic of small-scale turbulent dynamo that before equipartition is reached, that is, before the magnetic field Lorentz force has any significant back reaction on the flow, the power spectrum should be k to the 3/2, which is why I've overplotted that. So that's simply comparison with analytic expectation. What happens after equipartition is reached, that there is a back reaction, the back reaction suppresses further driving of the magnetic field, but it occurs first on the smallest scales. And then it kind of climbs the scales until the magnetic energy and the kinetic energy power spectra are comparable to one another at each scale. So that end state of scale by scale equipartition is what seems to be taking about 5 eddy turnover times.
So which equation of state
are you using? This is the Shen equation of state. So we use the realistic neutron star, a tabulated neutron star equation of state in these simulations. Although I have to say, I doubt the results would be terribly different if we used an ideal gas law. But we did that simply just to make closer connection with a realistic setting for neutron star mergers. OK, good. This gives us a sense for how this what type of resolution would be necessary in order to grow these magnetic fields in a short time scale. And it reveals why global simulations have a hard time reproducing this. I should say, though, that recently there is a Japanese group that's done a really good job just killing the problem with resolution. And they are getting close to seeing results that are compatible with these simulations of driven turbulence, which are way up here. So they've gotten resolutions that are effectively up to 256 cubed. And what I mean by that is the resolution per turbulent eddy. So this stuff I would say is essentially now confirmed by global simulations.
So,
so I was just gonna ask, so when you say it reaches equipartition, is that just sort of within a factor of a few or something? Or do you have I remember that at least the Japanese group was only getting sort of a few percent, or maybe you remember better, like maybe up to 10.
Up to 10, yeah.
In the magnetic field versus the kinetic energy.
Yeah, I think I seem to remember that.
Still due to resolution, or do you have a prediction for sort of?
So what we got was about 40%. Yeah. Although I think the driven turbulence setting is the most optimistic. If you were looking at turbulence which was instead driven by some type of an instability, my expectation would be that the turbulence may not be quite as volume filling as it must be if you're driving it continuously everywhere. So if the equipartition levels seem to be numerically convergent for 10%, I don't think I'd be that surprised. It would still be at a quite an interesting level, though. That would still be in the vicinity of 10 to the 16 Gauss. If instead they were getting 10 to the minus 4 vector partition or something, that might be a little concerning or slash not quite as interesting, if it's correct.
So if I can ask a question. So for non-relativistic MHC turbulence, like for accretion disk, this is alpha parameter, which is the ratio of magnetic, roughly magnetic energy or magnetic stress to gas pressure. And I think this is like abortive a few percent or percent level. So are you saying that it's bigger for relativistic turbulence somehow, that this ratio of magnetic pressure to gas pressure, or if I'm interested?
It may be different. So this, the ratio of magnetic to gas pressure is a different diagnostic. So what I'm comparing here is the ratio of magnetic pressure to sort of turbulent pressure. It is the energy densities in magnetic field versus the energy density associated with the kinetic turbulent motions.
Oh, but here you have rho not C S squared, not the but it goes to 10 to the minus 2 here. So you're saying if you calculate to compared to the kinetic energy, then it's the same.
That's right. The same, and we're 40% or so.
Okay, which is the same, I think, for non-relativistic turbulence.
It is, yes. Yeah, so I might point out that everything I've shown you so far is basically there's not much difference. So I'll be totally clear about that. We have not found any ways that relativistic turbulence is dramatically different from non-relativistic turbulence. If we were going to get technical, I could point out some ways that wave couplings are different in MHC turbulence. It's a little more technical. Yes, the general message has been, well, we may need to extend some of our diagnostics that were previously used for Newtonian turbulence, but they seem to apply. As long as we choose the proper relativistic generalization, that we see essentially the same types of dynamics. Okay, so I'll say a couple of things about gamma ray bursts. So this is a project I've been working on with Andrei Belgorodov at Columbia. And what we're asking is, if turbulence were to operate in the outflow of a gamma ray burst, would that be visible? Would we be able to see it? Would it have an influence on the spectrum of the emerging radiation? So let me try to explain first why we're doing that and what is a GRB. So a gamma ray burst is radiation that emerges from a relativistic plasma outflow. There are long bursts and short bursts. Long bursts are the result of the collapse of a massive star. And short bursts are the result, likely, of binary neutron star or perhaps binary neutron star black hole mergers. And they last a little bit shorter. The emission comes in two phases. There's prompt emission and there's afterglow radiation. The prompt emission, in a case of a short burst, is on the order of a second. For a long burst, it could be 10 to 100 seconds. It typically peaks at MeV energies, and it's rapidly variable. The afterglow radiation lasts for a much longer period of time, hours, days, weeks. In some cases, it's observable for months. It's well understood, and it's the result of a relativistic, very powerful blast wave that is launched by the initial explosion into the circumburst medium. Whereas afterglow radiation is pretty well understood, and it's historically it's been pretty stable in terms of what's necessary to model it. That's not been the case for prompt emission. The ideas behind prompt emission sort of keep changing. Prompt emission is very hard to model. There's a lot of complicated plasma physics that's going on. There are basically two categories for the prompt emission, and they're divided by whether that the emission that's eventually received by our detectors is coming from an optically thin region or whether it's coming from below the photosphere of an expanding flow. So this cartoon is intended to show optically thin. It's supposed to be photospheric. Optically thin emission it's been disfavored in the last 5-6 years. It's largely because it's being realized that it's very hard to recover the hard spectral index above the peak, the peak photon energy. If you assume that the photons come from optically thin regions. By the way, I don't know if I mentioned, these things are very non-thermal, all GRBs, so they peak at 10 MeV, but there are non-thermal spectral tails on both sides. So you might ask then, why are you talking about photospheric emission? You're saying this emission is so non-thermal, why think about the emission coming from a photosphere? Let me just say what that means, by the way. So this is supposed to be not so good, and this is promising. OK, so why think about photospheric emission if it's so non-thermal? So let me just say what photospheric emission is. What we have is an explosion that has launched a highly energetic, very hot blob of plasma into space. And it's initially optically thick. That is, its thing is radiation dominated. So it's a photon, electron, proton, positron plasma. Most of the energy density is in photons. And this thing is very optically thick. So none of those photons are escaping to be observable. Now, all that heat and pressure is pushing the flow and forcing it to expand to higher velocities and to larger distances. And eventually it coasts, it reaches a terminal Lorentz factor, and it continues to expand. As it expands, the collisions between the photons and the electrons get less and less frequent, and eventually the photons decouple. And as they decouple, they begin leaking out of the flow, and they eventually reach our detectors. So that's what photospheric emission is. It's those photons which were trapped and actually forcing the outflow to expand, essentially decoupling from the flow and reaching us. So if those are the photons we're observing, we would expect, in the simplest possible setting, we would expect them to be thermal, or Wien, at least. Wien is the spectrum that photons would have if the photon number is conserved, but they are in thermal equilibrium with the other components of the plasma. Now, so in photospheric emission models, how do we see anything that's non-thermal? The simple explanation is that the photons and the electrons are out of thermodynamic equilibrium. So what I'm showing here are radiative transfer Monte Carlo simulations of a photon and an electron-proton plasma, where what I'm doing is heating the electrons somehow. Now, I'll explain the heating in the coming slides, but the point here is that we're going to raise the electron temperature through some type of mysterious energy source. And what's going to happen is that those electrons will cool via inverse Compton scattering and transfer their energy to the photons. However, the equilibration time for the photon temperature to be raised up to the electron temperature is getting longer as the collisionality is going down. That is, as the flow expands and the collisions between electrons and photons are becoming less frequent, the time scale for the photon temperature to equilibrate with the electron temperature is getting longer. And eventually that can match the expansion time scale, which means that the photons are highly out of equilibrium. And that is the explanation within these photospheric models for why we observe non-thermal radiation. So the next question we got to address is, what is heating these electrons? And there are various energy sources that are proposed. The most conventional of those is referred to as internal shocks. So it's thought to be due to fluctuations in the central engine that's powering the outflow. So these internal shocks can be thought of as an internal energy reservoir. So there's free energy associated with bulk motions, and those bulk motions, the bulk flow collides, shocks, and heats the electrons. There's also magnetic reconnection models where the free energy was in the magnetic field. There's also nuclear collisions. This is proposed by Andrei Bilgorodov, 2010. This is where there's a neutron component of the flow which collides with the proton component. And the thing that we've been looking at recently is whether turbulence might also be a viable mechanism. All right, so I should say, if there's already these three, why look at another one? What's the motivation for checking out another possibility for heating things? So I'd say the primary reason is that it's likely there. So gamma ray bursts are seen to be violently intermittent, which suggests that the flow is inhomogeneous. And it's at a very high Reynolds number. In other words, it's inertially dominated. There's not very much viscosity. So I would argue that it is definitely there, and one ought to explore its consequences. OK, this thing got Andre and my imagination going. We realized that if a flow is radiatively mediated. So you have turbulence, which comprises mostly of radiation energy density, that this is a new regime of turbulence that hasn't been thought about yet. And we realize that there are two separate regimes for this type of radiative turbulence. We have a viscous and we have a collisionless regime. And this refers to whether the turbulence truncates at a scale which is larger than or smaller than the photon mean free path. Deep down in the flow, the photons will have a very short mean free path, and the turbulence will truncate at a scale which is larger than that scale. And as a result, the photons take all the energy from the turbulence directly, and so they're heated directly by turbulence. As the flow gets more and more optically thin, the photon mean free path gets longer, and the energy flux begins leaking through the photon mean free path, and it begins heating the electrons. The upshot is that when we do see radiation, if this flow is being heated by turbulence of some type, that radiation is coming as a result of electrons that were being heated by turbulence. Okay. Let's go forward because we're running out of time. The general take-home points to this are that most models, whatever the energy source for heating the flow, gradual photospheric heating models appear to be promising for explaining GRB prompt emission. And that these two regimes had not previously been pointed out, and there's also applications to this in black hole accretion flows. So black hole accretion flows are also radiative turbulence, and they will also manifest each of these two regimes. And there's similarly a switch from one to the other as the accretion flow gets closer to the black hole. So there's only 5 minutes left. There's one more section, but I feel like if there are any questions, I'd rather discuss the questions and maybe treat this last part offline. So should I go? Okay, I can do it in 5 or 6 minutes. Okay, so everybody knows that there's a binary neutron star merger.
That was 2 summers ago.
Oh no, it was. Oh, I still keep thinking it's like, it's probably August or September. What is it now, November? So in 2017, there was a binary neutron star merger. It produced a great deal of radiation to entertain us. That included a weak prompt emission and also included an afterglow, which has continued to be monitored by radio through X-ray observations. One of the primary debates that has been going on has been in reconstructing the event, trying to determine whether there was a successful jet. So this is a cartoon of what a successful versus an unsuccessful jet looks like. And as you can see, the main difference is that a successful jet breaks out from the environment of the binary neutron star merger. What I mean by the environment is that there is ejecta. So there was material that was dynamically ejected during the coalescence phase, and that provides kind of a cloud or a sheath. And if the jet is able to escape that thing versus if it does not escape it is a very important distinction, because it determines whether some hypothetical alien observers that were along the axis of this jet would have observed a gamma ray burst or not. That in turn is very important for us in terms of estimating how frequently binary neutron star mergers occur in the universe. You see, if we were to connect directly the rate of observed short gamma ray bursts with the rate of compact binary mergers, we would potentially far underestimate the rate. Because many of them may not produce gamma ray bursts, and also many of them are off axis, and so on. Anyway, there's been this ongoing debate over whether somebody saw a gamma ray burst from this thing or not. Okay. Also, it's important to constrain the geometry of these things. So if we can really reconstruct the geometry of the explosion that was responsible for the observed radiation, I'm not going to go into the details, but there's also a way through that of constraining the Hubble constant. Okay, so the reason for the debate has been that both seem to be able to fit the data. What I mean by both is a successful jet tends to drive a narrow shockwave shaped more like a cigar. So, something more like this. Whereas an unsuccessful jet drives a very wide shock, which is shaped more like an egg. And rather surprisingly, either of those explosion geometries can account for the observed afterglow. There's just that it's degenerate with the explosion energy. If we had a narrow cigar-shaped explosion, it would be required that that thing had more energy. But we can also fit the afterglow with a lower energy egg-shaped explosion. So breaking that degeneracy has been a main goal, because again, that is what differentiates between whether this thing did or did not power a gamma ray burst for some observers. So Andrew McFadgen and I were thinking about this, and we realized that after a year, this past summer, the remnant of this explosion was now a year old. It was expanding at about the speed of light, and it was only about 40 megaparsecs away, which corresponds to an angular scale in the sky of about 1 to 2 milliarcseconds, and that's potentially resolvable by VLBI observations. So in anticipation that such observations might be made, we did computer simulations, and then we synthesized radio sky maps. So what type of image on the sky would be seen of this explosion in both simulation models, which fit the afterglow. So the top and the bottom are different simulation models, both fitting the afterglow up through 230 days after the merger. As you can see, they have different morphologies, but not very different. So we were slightly disappointed in the sense that we could not convince ourselves that by looking at this thing, we would be able to differentiate between a failed or a successful jet. So we went ahead and published this. We argued a rather skeptical point of view. We pointed out different aspects of how this image would evolve over time, or to be observed again in the future. And we pointed out some potentially differentiating features. But overall, the message was that it's quite hard to use any potential radio observations to do it. So it was a little bit sad. Okay. Observations using VLBI were indeed taken. They were published about 3 or 4 weeks after we posted our paper on the archive. They were surprising for two ways. The first reason was that we were off by about a factor of 2. That wasn't terrible. We were off by a factor of 2 in the distance, in the angular separation of the radio centroid from where the merger actually was. That's not terrible. They were actually seeing an offset of the radio centroid that was about 2 times larger than what we predicted. So we got it right qualitatively, but we haven't yet accounted for this factor of 2. Okay, so a little bit surprising, not terrible. The other surprising thing was that the authors actually argued the opposite conclusion. They said that they were able to differentiate, and that their observations fully ruled out the failed jet model, and that the only remaining possibility was that GRB-17A was a successful jet and produced a gamma burst for some observers. So there's still tension between our analysis and theirs. And I think the right way forward is through more systematic exploration using Markov chain Monte Carlo modeling and doing a large suite of simulations to explore the parameter space. Anyway, they'll argue that they have firmly ruled out the failed jet. I kind of wish that was the case. It's a little bit more optimistic, but again, there's still some tension here. Okay, good. The last thing I'll say is that Xinyu Li has done a really nice job on a paper looking at relativistic turbulence neutron star magnetospheres. This thing has applications to magnetar giant flares and fast radio bursts. And this paper is on the archive, and Xinyu will be here, I think, in a few weeks, and he'll give, but I'm sure it'll be a really nice talk on that. So thanks very much.
So, questions? this factor of 2 discrepancy between the modeling and the observations, do you know what that points to? Does the change some other?
I don't think it's new physics. I think it's probably got to do with the density of the external medium. Mm-hmm. So an explosion will travel farther mm-hmm. if the medium was less dense. Okay. And yes, so I think we could account for that factor of 2, but it would require doing more systematic search of the parameter space. So what we have now are simply more constraints. So before we were trying only to fit an afterglow, and we had models that did it. And we could, in principle, jointly fit the afterglow with the radio observations to get both of them simultaneously. Don't think it needs anything exotic. I think you can reduce, you can increase the energy scale and reduce the density of the ambient medium, and you'll get a larger centroid shift. That's basically a consequence of the explosion traveling a larger distance in the ambient medium.
And so you're suggesting that you take those models and basically try to put the radio data and see with the failed in the field and a successful jet and see, you know, some sort of statistical likelihood of each one or something.
Yeah, I would say rather than just doing two, one failed and one successful, I would do a whole suite and continuously vary different dynamical parameters and do a proper regression analysis on that. So it's kind of for sociological reasons that we've just got these two main models. Like each group has kind of just copied the preceding group's work in order to you know, see if they got it right. But really, there's a much wider space of models out there that can be explored.
So what was the analysis that moving at all used to decide it was not the field jet?
They did very similar. They had very similar initial conditions to us. I could not tell from reading the paper how it was different, and I talked to Quilly directly, and still it's not quite clear on what they did differently. He also, I think, reading between the lines, I think he admitted to me that they could also have fit their data using a failed jet. But then he said something about a new data point, that they had actually thrown in a new data point from the afterglow, and then it might have actually been that more recent light curve data point, which really disfavored the failed jet. But there's noise about this. Then I talked to Rafael Margudi, and she said, no, the afterglow can still be fit by either model. So there's noise, I think, is the upshot. We're still not quite sure. We're using similar codes and similar initial conditions, but there could be some wiggle room there. I mean, maybe their initial conditions were just slightly different than ours in some way that we didn't account for. So it's not quite resolved yet.
Any other questions? So you just radiating turbulence you talk about. So when you are in this viscous region, do you also have like equal partition between photons and
neutrons? Good. Yeah, that's a great question. So deep in the flow, they do have the same temperature, but there's vastly more energy in the photons. It's an interesting regime. It's where you have a radiation, all of the energy, all of the heat capacity of the system is sitting in photons. And all the electrons are doing is just sitting there, they're just being glue. They're kind of just a scattering center. They're just scattering centers to endow these photons with collisionality. But the electrons don't carry any inertia. They don't carry any energy. The photons are running the show. So the viscous regime is where should I go on? I think. I didn't. This thing takes a while to wrap your head around. But this separation and the separation between the two regimes. we.
So you mean this could be the photons are somehow.
Yes. Yeah.
But then somehow in this collision then somebody get all this non-thermal.
It does. Yes. It becomes non-thermal here, and that's because of the fact that the equilibration time is getting longer. Yeah, because as the flow is expanding, that means that the collision time between photons and electrons is growing. And when that collision time is connected to the equilibration time, the time it would take for the two temperatures to equalize. And if that time scale is comparable to the time that the temperature itself is changing, then what you end up with out of equilibrium, non-thermal, and in particular, you get these unsaturated compensation effects, which can lead to very robust power law tails. You can actually get extremely hard spectra from this NDK. Yeah, I should say that this is a really interesting thing from a basic physics point of view. What we thought we were going to look at when we first were thinking about radiative turbulence, we were under the impression that we might do a full hydrodynamic simulation and put photons into it. and then let the photons bounce around with the turbulent flow and be upscattered by the bulk motions. So it's a process that's called bulk componentization, where instead of photons being upscattered by randomly moving electrons, they're upscattered by randomly moving bulk flow. And as you should always do, we thought before we did the simulations. And it occurred to us that, that if photons were moving on mean free paths such that they could actually sample the inertial range of turbulent bulk fluctuations, that would imply that they don't receive from the turbulence enough energy to suppress it. It takes a second to parse that. So if photons are bouncing like this between turbulent eddies, it's provable that they do not extract enough energy from the turbulent cascade to suppress it. What that means is that energy must cascade below the photon mean free path, and it will just cascade right along happily until it gets to the collisionless plasma scales. And to conserve energy, it must then heat the plasma. And if one follows this thing through to its logical consequence, they find that the electron temperature that will result from this heating is bound to be such that the electrons have a higher random velocity than did the bulk velocity fluctuations at the scale where the photons were sampling them. Yeah, so I know that's a mouthful. It takes a bit to parse, but the consequence is that this process, which has historically been referred to as turbulent bulk componentization, is actually not a thing. It can't happen. Or you might say it happens, but it's never the dominant process. Because if photons can sample turbulent bulk fluctuations, that means they're emitting energy flux to smaller scales, which also means that that turbulence is heating the electrons, which in turn means that the electrons move faster than the turbulent bulk fluctuations. And so the turbulent bulk componentization would always be a higher order effect than with the conventional thermal componentization. So there is certainly bulk componentization, and that is what's happening in this viscous regime. But it's not turbulent, because in that viscous regime, the photons have very small mean free paths, and they move in shearing layers at much smaller scales than where the turbulence is truncated. The turbulence has seen a viscous cutoff at a scale which is vastly larger than the photon mean free path scale in the viscous regime. In the regime, photons are mediating viscosity, and they're taking the energy directly from the flow, but they're not being upscattered by turbulent bulk viscosity. Yeah, so wherever radiative turbulence comes up in context, for example, in black hole accretion flows, I think this is just an important distinction to be aware of, that radiative turbulence has these two regimes.
Okay. There are no more questions. Let's thank Jonathan again.